Welcome to Making Data Matter, where we have conversations about data and leadership at mission-driven organizations with practical insights into the intersection of nonprofit mission, strategy, and data. I'm your host, Sawyer Nyquist.
And I'm your co-host, Troy Duick.
And today we're joined by guest Joe Squire. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sawyer. Thanks, Troy. Glad to be here.
And for folks just meeting you for the first time, Joe, could you share just a little bit about your background and what you do?
Yeah, so my background actually came from a nursing background and transitioned into data, where I worked as a clinical data analyst for multiple years, and I currently sit as director of analytics and data science for the Heart and Vascular Institute at UPMC out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And so varied background coming from the clinical area, but still working in healthcare now.
One of the things that's always fun about the data world is the backgrounds that people come from. And we were talking about this a little bit off camera beforehand about Troy and I's backgrounds aren't data. And then you came from a nursing background, which I don't think is a common background for data professionals, right?
No. And, you know, if there's any nurses listening to this, which I highly doubt is probably the case, but I would say like a majority of nurses are just very like data illiterate in some senses. Well, I shouldn't say data, I should say tech illiterate. So they shy away from working with any sort of raw data. They're not data illiterate because every day they go on and they're making interpretations of various data that comes into from the patient, whether it's labs or, you know, physiological data like blood pressures or something. So they are not data illiterate, but technically like you run into a lot of nurses and it's just, they don't want to deal with that kind of work. So they shy away from it and they dismiss it as soon as they see it. So I think that's why you don't see many nurses in that role. But there is a very big need for nurses to transition out of that clinical care setting and into leveraging data and helping healthcare organizations become what they strive to be, and that's providing the best care to the patients at the right time.
So, Joe, what got you to cut your teeth on raw data like that? Like, did you just have someone send you an Excel spreadsheet and you nerded out one day? What was that journey like to cut your teeth on that?
Well, it was completely on accident, to be honest with you. So I was working in a cardiovascular OR sharing call, 24/7 call with one other individual. So, you know, we saw like 2000 plus hours of call time a year. My wife and I just had our first kid, and I needed some work-life balance and ended up finding a position that at the time I knew dealt with data. But it was really just a glorified data entry position, that needed like clinical knowledge to do. But you know, as soon as I got into that, I became bored with the data entry portion of it and, you know, asked the question, okay, we're collecting this data. What are we doing with it? How do we use it better? How do we make a difference with it? And that's kind of where, you know, you get your gateway drug of Excel and you start messing around with stuff and then you kind of, and everything snowballs from there. And so that's really my career progression. It was just the natural curiosity that stemmed from an accidental move that was out of no other reason other than wanting to find a better work-life balance.
So one follow-up question to that is, many of us probably were cutting our teeth on Excel. And like you said, that's the gateway drug into the data world. But at some point, our thinking changes. There's this like journey of, you might be in that space of doing your pivot tables, or you've got some VLOOKUP formulas that you're doing to try to mesh data together. And then at some point, we're introduced to like databases or dimensional data modeling and data warehousing. So just tell us a little bit about that part of your journey to go from the basics of data in Excel to starting to think bigger, broader picture design patterns and how we can actually make this an enterprise solution for the workplace.
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing that comes down to is just the mindset of making data useful. And that concept kind of guides you and drives you to try to understand basically how do we automate things? How do we make things more efficient? And that's kind of what leads you from that, the basics of Excel. And I'm not saying like you have to move out of Excel, but there's a lot of people that their entire lives are based around the Excel environment. And it's a very powerful environment. And you can connect directly to databases with it and everything. But if you're thinking and you want to automate things that may not be, you know, as functional in Excel, then you're going to be looking to move out of that, looking to see what else is out there. And so that automation concept is really what drove me to be like, okay, what else is out here? What else can we find? And that's where you start understanding, okay, this is where the data is coming from. These are databases. This is how it's structured and everything. And, you know, you start looking at, okay, now I can actually plug in, say, a BI tool on top of this. Now I can automate that report that I had to do manual manipulations on to send out. And then you start learning your coding languages, whether it's SQL to bring that out or whether it's Python to do some more advanced manipulation or advanced analytics. And that's really where, you know, you get your juice. That, for me, that's where my curiosity juices get going. And I'll be honest, like ever since the whole generative AI explosions occurred, it really like helps you iterate a lot faster and explore more avenues more quickly than in the past whenever you were, you know, sorting through Stack Overflow or Googling things. Because now you can just type in like, hey, I have this thought, like how would this be possible if you were to do it in Python? And it would say like, these are the basic steps. There's a skeleton of code. And then you can just pull it out and start manipulating it and, you know, work on what you're doing a lot quicker. And this is kind of going down a rabbit hole, but as someone in a leadership position, that's very helpful because it exponentially ups your efficiency. And since your scope of what you're doing is much broader and it's not as technical, and you naturally have to move away from the technical aspect of your work, because if your head's down, you're not looking up and out. But with Gen AI, that efficiency gain really lets you also keep developing in some capacity to help your team out, whether it's offloading work or generating new ideas on how to look at the data or how to bring the data in from a different source. That's really some of the largest benefits I've seen with that aspect of AI augmentation, especially as a leader in the data field. But yeah, going back to your original question, this is how we go from Excel to everything else.
Now, okay, so Joe, you opened the AI box, so we're gonna go there, I guess. So as first of all, tell me a little bit about your team, and then even how you've thought about generative AI for how your team works, or what they're empowered to do with generative AI or ChatGPT, or what type of tools you've done there. So. Yeah, as a leader with team members, what does generative AI look like for you guys?
So my team, we sit within the Heart and Vascular Institute. So that's a service line within the hospital. Healthcare, like larger health systems, have these service lines, which are generally dedicated to specific procedures and disease processes. Ours happens to be cardiovascular, so heart, the veins and arteries, those types of procedures and diseases. And so much of the work that we do is centered around outcomes, like quality outcomes, research. We have a pretty big research lean where we help basically use the EHR data that we have to answer research questions and publish. And we also support the operational side in some capacity. In terms of generative AI, UPMC itself is a large Microsoft shop. So our approved AI, generative AI, is Microsoft, so Copilot. And currently right now they're trialing that across the system with certain individuals. I'm part of that trial. And Copilot's fine. I think it has a ways to go. I think that like some of the integrations are neat. I haven't found it extremely useful. Like, it's integrated into Excel, but I haven't really needed to use it a whole lot in there because I don't work super heavily in there. It's mostly just simple things in Excel. But in terms of empowering my team, it's difficult. So there's individuals. I would say there's experts in the field and they've been doing it for a long time. And so there's not a whole lot of need to look at, like, use Gen AI to do the work that they do, because they either have scripts that they've used in the past, they can easily modify it. They know exactly what they're going to do as soon as they go into a script. And I would also say there's an age factor in there. And this is generalizing, but from my experience that, you know, if somebody's older and they're set in their ways and they have that expertise, they're less likely to adopt generative AI than somebody who's younger. Sure. And who's, you know, not as set in their ways, or they don't have the extensive experience. And I would put myself in that bucket with a lot of the individuals that underneath me have much more, their technical chops are much better. They're much more experienced than I am. I mean, we have analysts and biostatisticians, and some of these individuals have PhDs, and it's just, they're much more experienced. So I am all for using generative AI, and if anybody ever wants to adopt it, I am more than happy to, like, help them, like, understand it and introduce it to them. But, you know, I'm not going to force it on them, because if you force it on them, they don't understand that idea of how can I leverage this to be more efficient kind of goes away, and they just see it as nonsense. And, you know, that's probably one of the biggest stumbling blocks I see with, like, the analytics world adopting generative AI. But there is like using, say, GitHub Copilot. It's basically like autocorrect and autocomplete for codes. And it's very efficient, because you basically start typing in your SQL and it'll bring up different ideas on what it thinks you're going to do. And it reduces a lot of redundancy of, you know, copy and pasting certain variables or statements and stuff. Yeah. And so that's really, like, one of my analysts really found that extremely helpful in upping their efficiency. And it was a newer analyst who is straight out of, I mean, they were still finishing their master's, but it was basically their first analytics position. And they really loved it. And they were very gung-ho on the whole Gen AI and how I can use it to work into my workflow. And so, again, it just reiterates that divide that I see in terms of people using it to augment their workflows. I think it goes back to experience. Like, if people, and I don't know why it is this way, but people with lesser experience tend to see it as, oh, this is very helpful, versus those that are older, where it's not necessarily they don't see it as helpful, they just don't see the use case for it yet. And I think maybe that comes down to workflow. So once you get products out there that inherently have it built into the workflow, like autocorrect has been in workflows for years and years and years. People get used to it and people will adopt it and understand it. And that's, you know, understanding is almost the entirety of that battle of adopting new technology.
Recently, I've been testing the Copilot features specifically for Power BI, and I've found that I like the more developer side of the Copilot tools, where it might enhance my semantic model by auto-populating the descriptions for all the fields. And I'm like, man, that saves me so much time not having to sit there and type these out, especially for any of the DAX measures and calculated columns. I'm like, man, if it can pick up some natural language from the code and populate that in there for my report builders, I'm loving it. But then the other side of that is some of the new Copilot features in the Power BI service for the report consumers and for dashboards, where you could have smart narratives, or you could have a conversation with Copilot about the visuals they're seeing in the report. I'm just curious, is that an area that your team has gone yet? Is that, I mean, it's really new on the Power BI side, and I'm not sure if you're using Power BI, but I'm thinking about those report consumers and where the role of Gen AI fits into the report consumers. That feels a little more concerning to me than the, you know, developer enhancements and efficiencies. What are your thoughts on that, Joe?
So as part of our trial, we don't have the Power BI Copilot initiated. Like, we're not allowed to use it.
Okay.
So, which I'm very bummed about because I think I probably would be heavily using it. No, I think that is a big white space and in the analytics community is that, you know, the ultimate thing that we kind of aspire to is that I shouldn't say it's the ultimate thing, but like the promise of self-service analytics has been out there for years and it's largely, you know, kind of fallen on its face. But I think that's an area where Gen AI can kind of meet those expectations if you model the data correctly, where you can like, okay, here's the use case. So you send that report out to the executive. It's 8 a.m. The executive logs into their email. They look at the report. They have some top of mind questions. Well, rather than firing email to so-and-so who then cascades it to so-and-so and so-and-so until it finally gets to somebody that can answer the question, you have that ability to do natural language querying where it can, I mean, ideally it would bring back a valid answer that's not incorrect, but you know, that's where I see that going. And I think there's a lot of promise in that and being able to search across the whatever data model you have, or even the entirety of a data, like a warehouse in terms of trying to find cool answers to questions. And really, and that's what analytics is empowering the business to make decisions. And if you can do that in a way that people are better able to find those answers, then we should go for it. I think that people have been working in that area for a while now. Like you see, like the smart narrative has been around for a while. But you know, the underlying model has probably changed at this point since it's been out. And I think that there's still work to do. And obviously it all depends on the data underneath it, but it's definitely an area that has a lot of promise, in my opinion.
So you talked about even just how data consumers, ideally that's the space where we can grow is they have self-serve analytics. They can consume data on their own more effectively than having to send 12 emails to find an answer to the question they saw in a report. Tell me a little bit about the people who consume data from you. Who are the stakeholders that your team interacts with? What's their perspective or culture around data? How data literate are they? Do they love it or are they resistant? I don't know. What kind of interaction do you have with stakeholders? What's kind of what's their role? What do they do?
Yes. I mean, there's a couple different stakeholders. The research side is a little different. It's kind of niche. So we won't talk about that, but let's do clinical outcomes. So we have an interesting model with clinical outcomes because a lot of it is geared around clinical registries, which are still largely manually abstracted. And so you have a person that actually goes into the medical record and they look for certain variables, and those variables are then put into a data collection form. And basically the purpose of these registries is to look at specific procedures or disease processes. And it's usually a national or international registry that then can risk adjust and compare all these sites and how you're doing to each other. But with those clinical outcomes, the registries in particular, the way we have it structured is we actually have the abstraction outsourced to a third party. And then for each registry, we have a subject matter expert who does data QA, QI, and then they also serve as basically like the educator. So they're the ones that are meeting with different teams, clinicians, administrators, to go over the data, tell people to understand the metrics, what goes into the metrics, what levers to pull to change those metrics. And so it's we were doing data literacy before data literacy was cool, but that's all I'll take credit for that. But it's an interesting model. And, you know, even though you have that set up, there's still people that will, you know, g- give you a hard time saying, oh, the data is not right, this metric isn't right, and so on and so forth. But, you know, it's something that you, the way that I see it is if somebody's engaging with you that way, they're at least looking at the data, right? And so you want, and that's, that means that you're actually making it meaningful for them in some way, whether they find it useful or not, they're at least looking at it, trying to understand it. And maybe they're engaging with you in a way that's negative, but you know, it's still engagement. It's still trying to understand, trying to make things work to get to that point where we can use that data to make those decisions. And so I think it's no matter how you have it structured, there's always going to be people that don't like what you show them, whether it's because the data is reflects negatively on them or because it's actually incorrect. So I think in terms of consumers and your engagement with them, it's really just a matter of being willing to listen, being willing to, you know, eat some humble pie and being willing to admit that maybe there is a mistake, going back to the drawing board, taking that look at it. But it's also being willing to put your foot down at some point and say, look, this is legitimately correct stuff. And you need to, you know, kind of partner with us here and figure out how we can change the direction of the boat and make this metric go the right direction.
That's a great conversation. And I love that you've mentioned two things. You were talking a good bit about data literacy and sort of how those executives and whatever stakeholders you're working with, they do need some level of data literacy, but you mentioned things like listening well and understanding them. So there is a role that we as data professionals need to be willing to learn the business literacy in order to bridge that gap. Otherwise, it feels like an impasse or stalemate in that, well, this is the data. Well, I don't like the data. And then you ended so well in saying, how do we partner together to turn that ship around, to actually make a difference? The data isn't the end all be all. It's got to lead to something where we're going to make changes based on the data to help this organization or this business. So I love hearing about success stories. So Joe, I'm wondering if you could tell us about one project or something that was like, this was a really good success. There might've been bumps in the road along the way to get there, but what was it like to see the light bulbs go on, see data being used in a way that whether it was positive or negative, that stakeholder was like, you're right, let's get on board, let's make a change. So I'm wondering if you have one of those examples where you could get a little more into the weeds and details of what that was like.
Yeah, I don't want to be a wet blanket, but I don't know if I've ever actually experienced that, sitting in a room and you're telling people all this stuff and all these light bulbs go on. I don't know if that's actually reality. Like if there's somebody out there,
dream, we may not have a moment. Yeah.
let us know if that's a real thing or not, if you've ever experienced it. But I would say that with projects that derive meaningful benefit, my perspective is biased because I'm from healthcare and things generally move slower in healthcare, but projects that drive meaningful benefit generally there's generally a long horizon on them. And so, and this leads to one of the benefits of staying at a company for, you know, more than 2 years, gives you that perspective, especially if you're working on projects of, okay, this is what it takes to deliver a project. This is what happens after the project's delivered. This is how you sustain a project. And so I think along those lines, one of the big things that we did was use these clinical outcomes to basically turn the ship around at our flagship hospital, UPMC Presbyterian, for our cardiac surgery programs. I'll be candid, the cardiac surgery programs there were floundering. The outcomes were very poor, and it wasn't just like one source of data that led to that change generation. There were multiple things that went on. I mean, it started with the the clinical outcomes where people are said, okay, something's wrong, we need to make a change. They actually did a lot of qualitative research to get that small data from interviews with individuals in terms of trying to understand, is there a cultural aspect to what's occurring? And you know, you put all that together at the end and you drive a path forward using that data to help guide, as well as pairing it with the business stakeholders and their input. And so there were leadership changes that occurred. There were practice changes that occurred. And it took a total of probably close to 5 years, really, to see a significant turnaround where we went from being, you know, the bottom quartile, basically, of clinical outcomes in our program across the country to the top 15% in the country. And so, you know, it's not always going to be like you, the data master, standing up there delivering a grand speech. It's going to be a partnership. And that's really the important aspect of it, is partnering with individuals. Getting leadership buy-in is huge. If you don't have leadership buy-in, you should just stop your project, basically, is my opinion. Like, if you can forward as many times as you want, but if that leader doesn't say, yes, let's do that, I'd say your failure rate is probably going to be like 98%. But yeah, partnering with people, getting that leadership buy-in, using that data in tandem with the business knowledge, and, you know, setting clear, definitive goals on what you want to accomplish. That's really the big things in terms of having a successful project that is data-driven and that actually succeeds and accomplishes something at the end.
So questions around you talked about outcomes a few times and like quality outcomes. And I'm guessing there's a large aspect of that that's quantitative, like that's data based. And how can you drill into that a little bit more or put more texture on that for me in terms of how do you measure outcomes, or what is a good outcome? What is a negative outcome in this world? Is it like, did the patient have a successful recovery or not successful recovery? Or like, what are the types of outcomes that you're measuring? Because it seemed like those were a linchpin for, oh, outcomes are down. We need to start transitioning to something different and making changes. So tell me about those outcomes that you were measuring and what that looked like.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different ways. Like any type of outcome is, outcomes can be measured with anything in healthcare. So you would have some type of patient contact, whether that's like at an office visit or whether it's a surgical procedure, and you can measure obviously an outcome from that. It'd be the same thing as somebody visiting your website and seeing, okay, did they make it to the cart? Did they leave stuff in the cart? Basically, now here is saying this person had a procedure. Did they have a surgical infection? Did they die? So it's very similar to that. It's just, we call them outcomes in healthcare. Yeah. And so like we'll use the cardiac surgery as an example. So there's outside of like the national bodies that actually risk adjust everything and not rank you, but they don't like to say rank, but essentially it is a rank. They assign you basically different quartiles in your performance. And so you can see that, like where you're sitting nationally or internationally. But for cardiac surgery, like the predominant ones are obviously mortality. Did the patient die after the surgery? And there's certain parameters around that. Okay, did they die within 30 days? If they did not die within 30 days or the hospitalization where the procedure occurred, then it counts as a surgical mortality versus if they were discharged and they died at 45 days, it's not surgical. And you know, you can get into like the whole idea of whether that's accurate or not accurate, because literally the patient could get hit by a bus at day 29 and that'd be a surgical mortality. But you know, chances are probably pretty low. So like surgical mortality and then major issues, like we talked about, like infection or whether they, you know, were on the breathing tube for too long, or they developed some kind of, like developed kidney failure, or they had a stroke or things like that. And so those are the big outcomes that you measure. And those are the ones that these governing bodies, they have risk models that are run, these outcomes are run through, and then you're stratified based on those risk models. And so that's just an example of some of the outcomes we look at within healthcare. But it's not any different than looking at how people interact with a website, like I said, or, you know, how people interact with a product or something like that. Like you have what the downstream effects are of that interaction is basically what an outcome is.
Yeah. And you have the advantage of, or I suppose what's different is there's some kind of national established ways of measuring certain things and measuring outcomes where some businesses are kind of left to their own, like, well, how do we want to measure this or what do we want? That's maybe one of the pros and cons perhaps of in healthcare is you have a lot of established standards for what things look like in healthcare outcomes.
Right. And that also, like, that comes to the discussion of sometimes you'll have people say, well, this metric isn't correct, even though it's a nationally established metric. It's like, we can only do so much if it's nationally established. But yeah, you run into those issues. And that's sometimes it'd be nice to be operating in an industry where it's like, we can actually tweak this metric and make it more accurate in our eyes. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you are. In highly regulated environments, you are held to those issues. And that's one of those things, like you don't have much control over those aspects. And there's an aspect of gamesmanship that comes in there, right? So making sure that you are doing what you can to make that metric look as good as it can be. It's not committing fraud, but it's okay. Is there like some documentation that needs to be tweaked that would make this metric better because it just needs to be in that. So, and you know, it's again, this you can get into a whole conversation about administrative burden and healthcare and everything else, but that is one of those. I wouldn't say it's just limited to healthcare. I'd say like highly regulated environments, like banking, would be another one where you see some of that stuff going on.
Yeah. What are the things, any metric that you give, and then when there's incentives wrapped around it, then you do end up with, gaming or at least optimizing for metrics because there's potential incentives or potential opportunities tied to it.
Right.
I'm curious about the next, if you look ahead 6-12 months, what are some exciting initiatives you are tackling or you see on the horizon for data or within your hospital or within the space? Healthcare space in general.
Yeah, so I actually have two big projects. One's still in the ideation phase, but one we're moving forward with. The one we're moving forward with is actually working with our clinical trial group. And so we have a group of research coordinators that part of what they do. And so these research coordinators, they get these clinical trials and there's long lists of inclusion, exclusion criteria for who would qualify to be recruited to the trial. And it's basically like a big, you know, a big logical if statement, like, so if they have this, or if they have this, or if they have this, and not if they have this, not if they have this. And so they're manually combing through charts, trying to find these people. And I was just working on some of the metrics recently. And some of these, four of the trials that we're looking at implementing what I'll talk about is, implementing what I'll talk about here in a second, they had for every patient recruited, it was about 120 to 180 hours of chart review for a single patient. That's astronomical, right? Like that's...
Yeah.
So the idea here is to take a company that was actually came through our enterprises arm at UPMC, which is basically like a they seed fund startups. And this group, what they do is they take, I think their underlying technology is based around NLP, because it was before the whole Gen AI boom, but they take this NLP technology and they build different models in terms of what it goes out and looks for. And so what we want to do is use this clinical trials group with the research coordinators, take this product that this group has, and then let it loose on our data to go out and basically call through the data to find people based on these inclusion exclusion criteria. So rather than spending 120 hours looking for these patients, they get a preset group of patients brought back, which they can then screen versus going out into the mass and trying to find these patients. So the idea is to, you know, reduce that amount of screening time, be able to recruit more patients more quickly. And that leads to things like, you know, expanding access for patients that need access to these trials, as well as increasing revenue for us because we get industry sponsorship for the patients that we recruit in. And so it's a huge benefit. And most people don't really think about like clinical trials and matching patients to those trials until you're in a position where you actually need to be matched. And so like a good instance, because I didn't even really fully understand it until recently. We had a friend of ours whose 2-year-old son had a rare cancer. And, you know, when they get diagnosed, you're sitting in the hospital and you think about, well, I only have this one opinion. I mean, fortunately, they're in Pittsburgh. It's a good opinion, but there are so many other people out there. There could be trials out there that could be treating this very rare form of cancer. But how do you actually find it? Nobody's actually looking. Like, the chances are that you need to make a decision fairly quickly, and you need to be able to do it with confidence. And so that idea.
And the amount of stress you're feeling right now too, as your child is going through something, like hard position to even make a decision too.
Right. It's hard to make a decision and you don't know if it's the right decision. And so that concept of being able to expand access to clinical trials, to be able to recruit more people into potentially life-saving treatments is a really, really important thing, in my opinion. And, you know, leveraging these analytic capabilities of people and their products and being able to do that and see if it actually can deliver is really one of the things I'm really excited about this year. The other thing that is currently in the ideation phase deals more with generative AI. And so this goes back to the clinical registries. I do have a group underneath me that still manually abstracts for these clinical registries. And, you know, there's going to be this retirement tsunami coming with this group because they're all in their late 50s or just hitting their 60s. And like, I can say that because they openly said that in a meeting to me. So, the thought is, can we use like AI, use AI augmentation? Can we put this into our EHR, be able to tell it, here are where we generally find the different data points, and go out there, get those data points for the certain parameters that need to be entered into the questionnaire, and bring it back with context. So then the abstractor themselves, as they work through, they can then reinforce that learning. And essentially what they do is, one, they increase their efficiency. Two, they're training something that is basically a knowledge capture of what they know and understand. Yeah. And three, it sets them up. It sets the person up who's going to take over for them as having a much less steep learning curve to take on that work after they retire. And so it's still ideation. I know I'm talking with one company about the possibility of that. But that's like super exciting for me because I've always been big on like with these clinical registries, there's a lot of like single fail points because there's a very deep knowledge expert like that sits with those registries, and to lose that knowledge is a huge knowledge loss. And so it's always been like a bug, like a thorn in my side in terms of how do we prevent that single failure point with this? And this looks to be possibly a promising way of doing that.
Yeah, I love hearing about efficiencies that can get built into organizations like hospital or healthcare because of how that opens up potential for people to get better healthcare, or the right people to get access to the right thing, or for it to scale in a way that it wasn't before. And so those outcomes and the people's lives that are actually affected by the work of healthcare are improved in meaningful, tangible ways through like technology efficiencies and data efficiencies in the background.
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing, like as you're talking about outcomes, Joe, I'm thinking there's still a clear outcome that is different from most of corporate America where it's let's just up the profits in our organization. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's a unique mission that healthcare has in the improvement of people's lives and well-being and all of those kinds of outcomes. And the fact that you do even have those benchmarks shows that there's concern for that aspect of someone's life that often gets missed in consumer goods and other kinds of services that are out there that aren't focused on human well-being. So I think that's a neat distinctive that certain nonprofit, not-for-profit organizations get to focus on, and it brings meaning to jobs that may be very energizing and exciting, as I'm sure you even relate to having been an RN and having that boots-on-the-ground experience caring for patients, and now you are translating that into your data experience. So I think that's a really neat part of this conversation that I've enjoyed listening to you talk about.
Yeah, and I would just temper that with, and I 100% agree with you, but I would temper that with saying every business is financially driven. So always have defensive metrics set up and ready to go. For instance, my biostatisticians and the research group, like it's amazing that it still exists, because you know, it's not like we're generating revenue, right? Like a lot of my group, there's no direct revenue generation. We have a few projects that do generate revenue. But so for instance, my research group, a big thing is like papers that we publish from that group. It's not just, oh, we're publishing papers. It's how many papers are we publishing in top quartile journals? Right now it's over 80% in the last year. How many people are getting eyes on this in terms of the citations from each paper, in terms of, you know, how many news outlets have picked up some of the publications, how many blog posts, how many mentions on X, and, you know, formerly known as Twitter. And, you know, that those kind of metrics are super important, because the bean counters aren't really thinking in that way. So being able to show them, being able to tell them that story of, hey, look, this is marketing. Like, that's what this is. Like, you cannot look at this purely as a cost center. This is something that actually gives meaning, whether it's, you know, marketing for the company, progressing the science, or, you know, helping clinical outcomes and making things better for the patients, because we're using that data to drive improvement. And so those kind of things, like, you have to be able to talk about that and convey that to those people that come in and are just looking at the bottom line. Because, at the end of the day, it's a business and you have to be financially profitable. And we just saw this. UPMC laid off over 1,000 people last week because we're in financial trouble. And because of that, like, you, that's when those defensive metrics, when those discussions happen, you want to be at the table, be able to say, look, this is what the team is capable of doing. This is what they've done. This is why they need to stay. And that is, regardless of the altruistic goals of your company, that will ultimately be a discussion at some point in most careers. Like, how do we keep this company financially viable? And you need to look at your services and what you're offering and what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. And you need to be honest with yourself too. Like, is what we're doing really worth keeping here? And so those are tough decisions. And those are decisions that people that move into leadership will naturally have to make. But if you're an individual contributor, like, you should be thinking about, okay, how do I measure what our team is doing and the output that we're putting out there, and make sure that the person leading your team, either they're tracking that or you get them thinking about it. Because if someone comes to you and you don't have any way of saying, here's our productivity, here's what we're doing for the org, I'm sorry, you're not going to get much sympathy from people that want to cut services.
Ooh, Joe, this has been fun, and we're coming a little bit closer on time, but a couple questions maybe before we're wrapping up. Tell me something you do for fun outside of work. Who is Joe behind Director of Science and Analytics?
You know, I'm a robot. I don't do anything fun.
All data people are just robots. Yeah.
I'm actually Derek. You know. So I have a wife and three kids, 8, 6, and 3. And so a lot of my time is spent with them. And so, you know, like going to soccer games or going to ice skating, things like that. And, you know, for fun, most recently I've been training for a half marathon. So that's been some of my stuff that I do for fun.
I think it's debatable whether half marathons are fun or not, but it's fun for you.
I had fun. So, I mean, those are the big things that I do. I don't have my hobbies vary. It all depends on the day of the week. I was really big into DIY for a couple of years, into winemaking for a while. Different random stuff that you just pick up and you start doing. And I think it's probably one of the big reasons why I got into data is because it lets you marry that creativity with the right-sided brain. And that's also one of the reasons why I couldn't go into the arts, right? Like, I'm not left-brained enough to just go like crazy. So you have that like right brain, like pulling you back constantly. And data gives you a nice balance with that, where you can be creative, but also use the logical side of your brain as well.
Excellent. Excellent. For sure. I think Troy and I both feel the same way about the data world. Mm-hmm. So, but before we wrap up, tell listeners about where they can find out more about you online. I know you do you do a lot of work around helping people get into data, and you have some content and stuff around there. So, yeah, if people want to find out more about you or look up some of the content you put out, where should they go?
Yeah, I mean, I really just focus on LinkedIn. I don't have I haven't really fostered any other social outlets. But if you just look for Joe Squire on LinkedIn, you can find me. And that's a lot of the work that I'm doing there. The original content was more on that, like helping people get in and upskill in data. And I still do some of that stuff with the base, like some of the technical stuff, mm-hmm. like what's out there. And it's shifted a little more with more toward like data leadership and those concepts. And it'll shift more. I'm going back for my master's in data science, so I think it'll be more on the advanced analytics side in the near term here.
Good stuff. Excellent. Well, Joe, thanks so much for your time today and for joining us.
One last question before you go. I've got to get this in there. I'm a huge dad joke fan, so I just have to ask you, what's the richest kind of air?
The richest kind? I don't know, Troy.
Billionaire.
Painful. All right. Thank you, Joe. Joe, thanks so much. Pleasure having you here. All right, folks. That's it for today. Thanks for joining us on Making Data Matter. I'm Sawyer Nyquist, and this was Joe Squire and Troy Duick. Thanks so much, everybody. We'll see you next time.